LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
The looming battle for control of our national legislature, with two New York political analysts, Tim Donner and Al Sharpton. It's politics, 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 all right now on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
If we're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country. Maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome back to The Uprising, a podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza, and joining me today is LibertyNation.com senior political analyst with a sly smile on his face, Mr. Timothy Elting Donner. Tim, thank you for joining us once again.
I always live in anticipation of where your pregnant pause is going to fall when you introduce me. Usually it's senior political analyst. This time it was Liberty Nation senior political analyst. I'm sure there's some message in that. I'll be damned if I know what
keep,
it is.
Keep you guessing. Keep you on your toes, Tim, so you can deliver.
It does do that.
The keen political analysis that we're after. I have to say that this week it's mostly political stories. I think we've got a somewhat merciful break from the deluge of legal stories that I have to do the heavy lifting to cover, and we can put some of the burden on your back to deliver some of these some information about these political stories.
Burden taken.
You know, I don't know if I think I mentioned it last week, but if I didn't, I'll mention it again. Where are the days when the Washington journalists got to coast during the summertime, Tim? Take time off, considerable amounts of time, and relax and leisure, and not worry about stories until the schools were back in. That's the days I pine for.
Well, it's the same today, because the schools go back about August 1st now.
Yeah, well, I guess you're right. So, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah,
counselor, there should be a constitutional amendment or a law forbidding school to begin anywhere in the country until after Labor Day.
You know, when I was a kid, the great summertime business economy rested on youth labor. Me and my friends that went down to the shore and worked and to the beach or worked at amusement parks or whatever. It really was that, you know, this huge mass of influx. What do they do now?
They don't work.
Yeah.
I mean, this is this whole thing. I don't know if you've been sort of following this, what they're calling quiet quitting.
Yeah.
Quiet quitting, which
by the way, was always just phoning it in, right? Didn't we always have that? It was just called phoning it in.
Right. Like
it was.
Except now people brag about it on social media. It's like a badge of honor, just like having had an abortion is a badge of honor on the left.
There was always a place for people who didn't have ambition with their jobs or careers, both in the public and private sector. Everybody who's worked at a company, I think, you know, that Harold comes in at 9 and leaves at 5 and don't ask him to do anything outside of that schedule. And then there's, Henrietta, who is trying to become the vice president, and she'll take any work that you can give her and make sure all the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed. Right. I mean, is this something that's actually new in the world?
Yeah, it's just, I got to say, Scott, the pandemic just threw everything into turmoil because so many people weren't working. And then they got handouts from the government, whether justified or not. At first they were, to be sure. But by the time Biden came into office and did the so-called American Recovery Act, which meant throwing another $2 trillion into the economy, it not only stoked inflation, but it kind of settled a trend that occurred during the pandemic, which was, hey, I can get away with not working. everywhere you go, everywhere, people complain, I can't find people to work, or I can't find qualified people to work. I called a doctor yesterday for an appointment, routine appointment, and the message, the recording at that office was, please understand that because of the pandemic, we are short-staffed. And I'm sitting there and blah, blah, blah. It's not their fault, but it's the point, short-staffed. There's 11 million with an M jobs unfilled in this country. And yet everybody's complaining there's a labor shortage. Something's not computing, Scott, and I can't figure it out. And nobody I talk to, including our own economics guru, Andrew Moran, can really figure out what the heck is going on with his labor market.
All right, Tim, for me, I think the biggest political story of the week, the life cycle of the political life of Stacey Abrams. We've got a lot to talk about with the battle for the Senate and with abortion politics, but this is kind of like an interesting microcosm of a story. And I always thought that Stacey Abrams was a power players candidate. In other words, like people who pick other people to be in power, who get to decide, who gets plum kind of assignments and opportunities, they granted them to Stacey Abrams. She was, from a very, very young age, I think 16 or something like that, involved in like national political issues at a level that had really people reaching down for her to give her, the hand to be one of the chosen people. And kidding aside, right? The people who actually vote never sort of agreed that she was going to be one of these
one who would reach the promised land.
It's sort of like Obama without the popular support. It's like she's got all the support from on top. Okay. Pulling her up, media, other politicians, sort of establishment types, you name it. Everybody's in favor of Stacey Abrams, but she can't get it together in the votes. Let's take a look. Mm-hmm. You reported on Ms. Abrams' currently failing campaign to become governor of Georgia in the pages of the sponsor of today's podcast, in LibertyNation.com. The people's source for conservatarian news and analysis.
I love the way you
24/7.
Do that.
And you say that the headline is Stacey Abrams' progressive caricature.
I love when you speak French. Go, man.
Yeah. Thank you for that. But as you say, something happened to Abrams on the way to the governor's mansion in Atlanta. And please elaborate. What happened or didn't happen, I guess, more precisely?
Well, in 2018, she ran against Brian Kemp. And lost by about 54,000 votes in a certified result, Scott. She refused to ever concede that she lost the election.
She won because she brought out issues that were important to voters in Georgia, Tim. That's why that's how she won that election.
Yeah. Well, she has, she is the bookend to Trump in terms of refusing to concede defeat. And so that does not accrue to her benefit. She really came off as a sore loser. People don't like that.
But she's rewriting that history now. I don't know if you saw, she was out on The View yesterday, I think it was, and proclaiming that she never pretended that she didn't,
Right. You know what she said? Here's what she said. She said, well, I don't go around claiming that I'm governor, which is supposed to distinguish her from Trump. The problem is, she was never elected governor. Trump was elected president.
Yeah.
No, there's a pretty distinct difference, but this is going to be harped on, but even more so, Scott, and we're going to play it. The comments that she made about her own state. I mean, it's a stunning development when someone who's running to govern the entire state blasphemes the state and says it's a terrible place to live.
Yeah.
So
we'll run that here in 1 second. I would just say that
it also, by the way, just to complete the circle,
a great candidate on paper. And what I mean by that is, she doesn't have just to look at her as a person to meet. You don't know a thing about how what she feels about abortion or whatever, right? She has a really good voice. You know, wouldn't you give her a job as a radio announcer calling the news or something like that? She's very pleasant to listen to.
Her oratorical skills are impressive.
She's pleasant to look at. She has.
But there's other things, Scott, too. Her fundraising skills are very impressive.
Oh, no, I was going to go down the list, right? But like and all
her,
these
right.
things
and her very attractive candidates.
Yeah. If I was going to run against her, I would be just based on all that presentation stuff. You think this is an uphill battle. All right, let's.
Tuesday is a big day.
I'm ready to help because I know that we have to have a conversation about who we are in this state and what we want for each other and from each other. I am tired of hearing about being the best state in the country to do business when we are the worst state in the country to live.
Is that a way to appeal to the voters of Georgia? And then she gets, you know what? She gets, here's the thing to tell you about her audience. When she says that, she gets huge applause.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
She right. gets huge applause. So she is appealing to the most left-wing kind of Democrats. And 2020, in a lot of ways, saved her career as a prominent leftist. But I think it created the sense that she could take that kind of agenda all the way to the governor's mansion in Atlanta. And I think she's finding out that she can't. You hear the audience that she's appealing to when they applaud wildly after she says it's the worst place in the country to live. So she, I think, had a false sense of importance because things have died down. Of course, Black Lives Matter is no longer trendy. It's now largely anathema once we know what they've done with the money and their absolute inability to handle it constructively, shall we say, without going into the weeds. So now she's trying to sort of run on a 2020 agenda, and it's not working. She's behind outside the margin of error, and she's flailing away. And even the New York Times did a story saying that Democrats are panicked about her chances in Georgia. And she's also, Scott, running against a popular Republican in Brian Kemp, even though he shooed away Donald Trump pretty effectively. But
you say even though, I think that's more like masterfully. He somehow managed to be one of the unicorns who is a non-Trump guy, but somehow is able to not earn the full-on sort of hate stream from Republicans who turn on people who hate, you know, who are rejecting Trump, right?
He has really walked that line effectively. And so I expect he's going to win now.
What's the magic sauce there for him in doing that? How's he been able to do so?
I think he's just appealing to sort of traditional Georgia conservative small C values and talking about his stewardship of the state budget, talking about his, you know, sort of centrist dominated leadership. He's got appeal as kind of a calm, centered kind of guy as a governor. And I think that's worked to his benefit. I mean, look, he had a Trump challenge from this guy, David Perdue, who used to be a senator from Georgia for a short while. And Perdue challenged Kemp because it was a revenge endorsement by Trump. And David Perdue was beaten by Brian Kemp 75-25. I mean, it wasn't even close. So she faces not only a pushback against this woke ideology, which is becoming discredited across the nation, but also the fact she's got a good candidate and a mainstream candidate she's running against.
When you say woke ideology is being discredited across the nation, do you mean as a political
voters.
Winner, as a political
yes.
winner. Okay.
Well, you've said it before, go woke, get broke.
Yeah.
Get woke, go broke. However you want to put it, it's not a winner in the long run. And she's got to find a way to tamp down her image as a radical. And I don't think she'll be able to do it.
Okay. There was an interesting take I heard from Crystal and Sagar about Ms. Abrams and her kind of her fortunes changing because her message has changed. Let's go ahead and listen to them and hear your analysis of that.
her whole, the whole Stacey Abrams mythology was about how she'd built this machine in Georgia to register voters and turn them out for Democrats in a way that it had never been done before. And Democrats tend to get obsessed with these sort of like procedural or campaign mechanics rather than like a policy agenda that's going to energize people to bring them out. And perfect contrast here is Trump in 2016, their campaign was a mess and a disaster, but he, for better or worse, in my opinion, worse, resonated with a large view and brought out new voters that weren't voting in the past. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much about the mechanics of are you registering and who are you and how is this all working? What does that operation look like? You got to have those mechanics in place. That helps. But you also have to have something that is motivating people to want to go and vote. Otherwise, it's like, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink it. So her theory of the case that just having those mechanics without the overarching vision, message, material, like delivery for constituents, that you could just have those mechanics and that would be a success, that's being undermined by the fact that she is underperforming where Warnock is ultimately.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on that one. But I just do think it's good to dispel the myth of Stacey Abrams and learn the hard lesson of politics, which is sometimes it does have to do with candidate quality, but a lot of the times it doesn't. And it has to do with much more multifaceted factors. And it, you know, people like her build entire narratives. I mean, she's become a multimillionaire, basically grifting and selling these fake books. I mean, didn't remember that thing I did about how she has a book on like how to be a good manager in business.
Oh, yeah.
You've never run a business in your life. What are you talking about? Your greatest skill is raising $5 million from Michael Bloomberg for your charity. That's really what you're good at.
That was the thing that always, right. She was the perfect case in point of like the just celebrity coverage approach to politics.
100%.
There was zero analysis of like, what does she actually stand for? Yep. What did she actually do in the Georgia legislature? It was all this very sort of, it was like TMZ, only for politics and elevating Stacey Abrams. So anyway, I was a little bit surprised she even ran for governor because to me it was very predictable that it would be a very tough slog and a much harder road than it was last time around, just facing an incumbent governor in a more difficult year. So I was kind of surprised that she went for it. But I guess in some ways, having not gotten pulled into the Biden administration, it was her only move.
Yeah, I think you're right.
When I saw this clip, I just had that realization of, that's right, I had forgotten about them floating her for...
Well, that was in my article on LibertyNation.com. She was mentioned.
But she put it out there.
She was on the list.
She had these,
the reason...
Her allies were making it like she was... Like, everybody who's running for president has to confront whether or not to name Ms. Abrams as their VP choice or not. That's how... elevated.
Well, let's remember that Joe Biden cut down his potential VP field by about 75% by saying he had to take a woman. And then after George Floyd, he said he had to take a woman of color, which made a very short list in terms of people that they thought would work and be palatable on a national basis. And it's only because of that that she made the list. It was Kamala Harris, her, and then there really wasn't anybody else. So she got mentioned. But it's hard.
Are you saying that she was an affirmative action choice? How dare you?
No. Neither was Kamala Harris.
Or our newest justice, Ketanji Brown Jackson. Another pick from a universe of tiny numbers because of pre-selection for immutable characteristics, namely race and sex, against federal law if you're getting a job at the post office. But
that's true. But I'll tell you this much from what I know about her. Ketanji Brown Jackson would be a much more impressive vice presidential choice than Stacey Abrams, to be sure. But
Stacey Abrams has only had a successful campaign for office. She's like the Pete Buttigieg, one of these people who like, you look at the actual numbers of people that have actually who voted for this person. It's just they can't move the ball that much. They're candidates.
I thought, honestly, she did pretty well to get within 54,000 votes in 2018 as a Democrat in Georgia.
What's the voter registration split in state of Georgia?
I'm not sure, but I think it's still majority Republican. I'm not sure.
I tried to look it up very quickly before we went to record here on Thursday, September 15th at 10 something in the morning. And I didn't see
thing
it.
Is, though,
one thing I did notice, though, is that the state's like racial makeup, it's barely majority white. It just seemed like very favorable for a candidate like Stacey Abrams in 2022 to be able to run in.
Well, okay. But again, a lot of that was the energy of being anti-Trump in 2020. Yeah. Now, look, Stacey Abrams really pulled off something masterful and extremely significant, even though she's never won office. She's the one that engineered the victories by Warnock and John Ossoff in those two Georgia Senate races in January 5th of 2021 that gave the Democrats the effective majority at 50-50 with the vice president breaking the tie. I mean, she really did get out the vote. She organized that state.
Now, Warnock is one of these rich civil rights guys, right? He's for civil rights, but somehow he's able to turn it into a fantastically successful financial... Well,
you know what I think, just to finish the other point, is that I think Democrats across the nation are extremely grateful to her for engineering this takeover of the Senate. I mean, that was truly impressive. However, that doesn't translate to the voters of Georgia necessarily this year. Warnock has used a very different strategy, which is why I think he's running so far ahead of Abrams comparatively. And that is that he's trying to appeal to moderates and shall we say, moderate Republicans. He's trying to appeal to the center. I'm sorry.
What are the numbers? You said he's doing much better than Abrams in the state, relatively speaking. Right? So he's at what percentage?
Well, again, take these Senate polls with a grain of salt, because some of them have been wildly inaccurate.
Right. Well, the latest. Well, the best we have to look
at. Well, in Georgia, Warnock was ahead by as many as 10 points, but the latest polls that have come out, the last two, have Walker actually overtaking him and holding a slight lead in the Real Clear Politics average. But it's competitive. It's very close, because Warnock is trying to appeal. He's more of a sort of mainstream type of character. He also is a successor to Martin Luther King at Ebenezer Baptist Church, which, of course, is legendary in Georgia. So he's got some things going for him, but the main thing is he's trying to appeal to a broad electorate, whereas Stacey believes she can win by appealing to a hard Democratic base that hates Trump and Trumpism. And I think that she has not read the room properly here in 2022.
Well, she's got the far tougher competition, I think, than Warnock has, right? I mean, Herschel Walker, as those of us who are football fans know how to say, Olympian as well. He's an Olympian. Wasn't he on the bobsled team?
Was he? I didn't even remember that.
Let's go ahead. Let's go to the tape right now.
Winning the Heisman Trophy. I remember his NFL career.
Yeah. And he's one of those guys who just such a remarkable athlete all around, you know.
Right. He's an athlete who happened to play football. Right.
Yeah. Olympic bobsled. While still an active NFL player, according to the Wikipedia, Tim, he competed in the 1992 Winter Olympics in Albertville, France, as a member of the United States bobsled team.
Good for you for remembering that.
Absolutely. He's a proud member of the Philadelphia Eagles once upon a time as well.
Well, since he did bobsled, I think he's trying to use that as an appeal to white voters. Bobsled is not a sport that you see a lot in American communities.
Right.
But the point is that, look, Warnock was way ahead according to polls. Now he's slightly behind. But Herschel Walker, I mean, he is a guy that is a loose cannon. And, you know, he didn't reveal that he'd had children out of wedlock and they found out the wrong way. He made some statements that were truly sort of jaw-dropping in their ignorance. But the National Party came in and sort of took control of his campaign and steadied it. And now he's, I'd say, you know, that's a toss-up now between Walker and Warnock. I mean, Walker has the name. He has the legendary status. He's got the love of the people of Georgia for what he sort of did for the University of Georgia and for the state as a whole in terms of their image. But he's got all kind of liabilities in terms of his actual qualification to be a senator. I mean, because he's never held office before, and he does not come off as being very much in the way of depth and breadth on understanding the issues.
Yeah, I just wanted to say for the record, one of my sort of pet peeves politically is are people that hold themselves up as sort of what's the right word? I'm talking about Raphael Warnock now, and I mentioned about his profit-seeking activities, and you said that he was sort of the, you know, the placeholder. Well, you didn't say placeholder, but he has Martin Luther King Jr.'s old job, basically.
Right.
He has not committed himself to, you know, basically living amongst the poor and elevating them. He is a person who uses his position to enrich himself and make money and put and stuff his pockets.
His circle.
Plenty of people do that, but also. Yeah. I just don't like it when they're hypocrites about it wear the cape of, you know, charity when they're it really starts at home for so many.
His sphere of influence, shall we say, is sort of different than Stacey Abrams. She's grassroots, hardcore, far left, Black Lives Matter type of orientation, whereas he's more trying to present himself as a sort of mainstream, particularly urbane kind of politician who can appeal to people, and that he just sort of happens to be Black.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, he'll use that. That will be an advantage for him, but not a big one because, of course, Herschel Walker is also Black. So he's got to appeal, I think, more on a basis of ideology than Stacey Abrams does because she's running against a white guy and Warnock is running against a Black guy. And in this age that we're living in, that kind of stuff seems to matter more than it ever has.
Have they called Herschel Walker a racist yet for having the temerity to run against a Black man who's a...
I think somebody actually called him a white supremacist, but I'm not
That's
sure.
So funny.
That's the Black guy is a white supremacist. It wouldn't be the first time, by the way.
Oh, certainly not. Say, no, of course.
He's not down with the cause. He's not authentically yeah. Black. So
Right. Yeah. Well, let's turn our attention to the Senate writ large, away from Georgia specifically. You've written about the battle for the Senate in the pages once again of today's show sponsor, LibertyNation.com. Tim, let's ask outside of Georgia where, let's flash forward to Pennsylvania if we can, just because it's the state I was born in. And it seems like the Fetterman versus Dr. Oz has really got multi-layered there.
Boy, does it.
Let me ask you as an entry question, just because I haven't, you know, I mean, I started paying kind of attention to it a little bit, maybe 2 weeks ago when the Oz stuff started really kind of breaking. But does John Fetterman, does he own like a suit and tie, a shirt with a collar and a button on it? I keep seeing him in these hoodies. And then I saw some allegation, somebody pointing out that he has this off-putting sort of hump-like affecture on his neck, which may be part of his health crises.
He's a bizarre person.
What's going on there?
Well, first of all, he comes from an extremely wealthy family. So this whole business about the hoodie
and
all his progressive beliefs and everything doesn't really strike as authentic, although he has gotten a lot of credit for sort of being a regular guy, unlike so many politicians. He's trying to play.
He's not going to order a courvoisier at the bar. He knows.
I mean, I don't know. Do you want a senator that wears a hoodie? I mean, I'm not sure that I do.
If he's gathering brush or mowing the lawn, yes, but not one that's undiscoverable in a suit and tie.
Here's this is a race, Scott. This is a classic case of not which one's going to win, but which one's going to lose, which one is going to be the worst of the two, because, I mean, Dr. Oz has the elitist thing now.
Carpetbagger, elitist.
Elitist hung around his neck.
Yeah,
right.
Celebrity. And all the negative ways that it makes a celebrity.
He does not have the enthusiastic support of MAGA Republicans, so to speak. They're very weary.
The most racist, worst people in the world, Tim, the MAGA Republicans.
Threat to the Republic, Scott. Threat to the Republic.
Right.
Please get your quotes correct. So the thing is, you know, Oz looked like just a terrible candidate because he's a carpetbagger and an elitist, as he's being depicted, the whole crudité mess, which is just, it would be so laughable if it wasn't sad, or maybe it's the other way around. But now it's starting.
I like it the other way around. It's
starting to turn now where people are saying, wait a minute, this guy Fetterman had a stroke 4 days before he won the Democratic primary. And it's clear that he is being evasive in terms of debates. His speech is halting. It's uneven. And it's clearly because of his stroke. And he's doing his best to try and avoid that. But he's not really coming clean, because his staff said, oh, it's a minor stroke, he'll be back in the saddle quickly. And now he's saying he can't debate weeks later because it's part of his recovery.
Oh, is this the latest news? Is that he's refusing? I thought that he had actually
It's back and forth.
Okay.
He's apparently agreed to one debate.
Yeah, okay.
But that seems to be up in the air at this point. Dr. Oz wanted about three debates, and that accrues to Dr. Oz's benefit because he thinks he can beat him in a debate, and he probably can. He's very articulate, Dr. Oz. Fetterman, I haven't heard talk as much, but this race is just a race to the bottom, Scott.
Do we have other U.S. senators that are dual citizens of countries?
No, well, that's right. The other thing is that Dr. Oz is a dual citizen of U.S. and Turkey. I don't know whether people would like question his loyalty because he has dual citizenship. I don't know if Fetterman.
It is kind
really
of interesting, though, to want to be a senator from a country and then maintain. I mean, I aspire, Tim, of course, as you know,
social
climber that I am. I aspire to be a person of means and import that I could have multiple citizenships, like a Dr. Oz. But I would think if I was running for Congress, I would renounce other citizenships. Is that I guess so.
Yeah. I mean, that's a problem on top of the elitism thing and the carpetbagger thing. It's a sort of a trifecta that goes against him.
On the other hand,
if the people of Pennsylvania think that a guy that they could vote for has become essentially incapacitated or to some degree unable to fulfill his position, would they really vote for him? I think that's a question. It's pretty obvious at this point that Fetterman is not in the middle of a very rapid, quick,
all right. I got
decisive
a
recovery.
I got
you know,
a poll
but this
question
is a critical. This could be arguably the most critical race in the nation, Scott, because the Republicans need to hold the seat for the retiring Pat Toomey, and if they lose that, then they're going to have to win all the other states that they already control and pick up two seats that are now held by the Democrats. Most likely those seats most likely for them to take would be Georgia that we talked about, Nevada and New Hampshire.
Let's say you live in state X, Tim.
Yeah.
And in state X, there are two candidates running. One is a roughly speaking, checks the big boxes for you on the issues. And the other one is, let's say, Stacey Abrams, okay? But your candidate has the John Fetterman health situation,
right?
Okay? You're going to vote for the ideas, not the person, right? I imagine.
But I think I'm maybe not the exception. But if you assume, let's say, I'll be I think this is fairly accurate. Let's say 40% of people are going to vote for Fetterman, even if he's on life support.
Yeah, that's why I didn't think it was right. impressive.
But wait a second. Let me finish. 40% are going to vote for Dr. Oz, even if he gets there and pledges his loyalty to exclusively to Turkey. Okay, so it's the other 20% in between who are not ideologically.
Punxsutawney Phil would get 40% on either side,
right?
If they ran him. It's the margin in the middle that they're fighting.
It's the other 20% who are not voting so much on ideology as they are on competence and the ability to do the job, and factors, basic factors like that. That's where I think Fetterman can be hurt, unless he can demonstrate that he is pretty much healthy and there's no lingering questions about his ability to perform the job. Because I'll tell you this much, Dr. Oz is not going to let up on it. He's, you know, he's trying to toe the line between being cruel and being politically astute, and it's a hard line.
He's got some extra ammo in his quiver there because he's a doctor, right? So he can say, listen,
correct.
I've seen.
Well, he did say something. Maybe it would help John Fetterman if he actually ate a vegetable from time to time, which I thought was an interesting thing to say.
Is he obviously out of shape or something like that? Besides the weird hoodie stuff, I haven't actually seen him.
I don't know. But yeah. I do think, you know, the factor of how you appear, you're talking about the thing on his neck. But I think just to put a pin on the Stacey Abrams thing, I mean, I think we sort of left out the elephant in the room, which is that she is massively obese. And I think, look, that's got to hurt her to some degree with some voters who believe that.
You think she's that out of shape that she actually loses votes? See, I actually think that she has I don't see her that way. I think that she's probably non-threatening to women voters, and she has a lot of people gap-tooth smile that I mean it in a charming way. I think that her overall look is good. She looks like everybody's high school principal to me, or something like that. Like she has
I agree, but that's you and I, and there's a lot of people. I've had people tell me over time when they see someone who's particularly obese, they say, look, that person can't control themselves. They don't know how to regulate their lives. And there's people like that out there who would be put off by her appearance. Look, I don't know how many. I'm happy
for the conversation because I think that she wins on image. Not loses on image.
There's difference between image and appearance.
I'm including it as one thing.
Okay.
Image also
takes into account what she said about things, her most controversial remarks, her agenda, as a social justice activist. That's most important to her image, because I think most of the people that vote don't give a damn whether she's black or white. They only care what she believes.
Well, we know that. I think that it's only fair to say that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez certainly benefits from being, you know,
attractive.
Not just attractive, right? Obviously, she's stunningly attractive. I think she's.
Let me ask you that. So, how many votes do you think AOC gets because of her appearance? Right.
Here's what I would say to you. I don't know if it's a direct vote correlation, but she gets so much attention. If you are a nightly news producer and you got to put something on the screen, you want to put on AOC or do you want to put on
Omar?
Well,
yeah, given the choice, you'll put on AOC. I think part of the fact she became so visible was her appearance, because she's, you know, so hot to trot in the eyes of so many people that, you know, it's like, okay, well, I can listen to her a lot longer than I would any other sort of socialist.
I think that Ilhan Omar, by the way, just like AOC, while her politics are the metaphysical opposite of mine, I think she's very attractive. And that's probably one of the reasons why she also has been successful, is because
But she wears the hijab, you know, she'll wear the hijab and the head covering. So it's not as easy to make an assessment of her looks. I mean, the men that rate women by, you know, a numerical scale of looks, it's hard to do it with her because she has, you know, her hair, which is a critical part of a woman's look, covered. So you can't really get the kind of complete assessment that you do with someone like AOC. How's that for deep analysis, Scott?
You know, I just went to like the picture page of her, and I'm just seeing her with her colorful head wraps and bright smile and straight white teeth. I think as a again, not counting about any single political belief, just looking at a person physically, I think she has an excellent look to be on brochures, on TV, on the internet, to say this is somebody who we want to put up as a representative of our, you know, XYZ.
So what you're essentially saying, Scott, is that she is clean and articulate.
Right. But better than that, I'm clean and articulate, but I'm not attractive in a way that I think Ilhan Omar is.
People know that, by the way, that was what Joe Biden said about Barack Obama. We know it, but yeah. When they asked Joe Biden in the 2008 campaign what he thought of this new guy, Barack Obama, entering the fray, he goes, well, he's nice new African-American, unlike some of them. I mean, I don't know that he said unlike some of them, but he said,
this all is going to the trash can. I can say that right now.
He's articulate and clean. Now, I just love that word clean. Like, if a politician is clean, what does that mean? I mean, I was always intrigued by Biden calling Obama clean. What does that mean to you?
I was distracted, Tim, because I just went to look at some images of Stacey Abrams, and she's generally photographed from like flattering angles and stuff. I'd be interested in some kind of opinion polling about whether or not she is getting
she's running
less support because of her.
It's good
BMI.
Question. She is running against the absolute vanilla standard issue white guy.
Yeah,
I mean, Brian Kemp is the most generic looking politician you've ever seen. He's neither, you know, attractive nor unattractive, not too heavy, not too light, not too tall, not too short. You know, right. he's like out of a strategist profile of an inoffensive candidate.
Right. Well, let's look at some other Senate races. You mentioned Nevada a little earlier, but I didn't hear you mention other states besides Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. Are there that are in play that you're looking at as you take a glance at the races?
Yes, I think the race that I really had written off for the incumbent because he's under such heavy attack. But now it seems to have turned it around. The Democrats thought that Ron Johnson in Wisconsin was extremely vulnerable because he was one of those MAGA Republicans who supported, I guess, some or many of Trump's claims about the 2020 election. So they targeted him. They poured in millions, tens of millions of dollars into Wisconsin and will continue to try to take him down. And he's been behind in the polls until the last poll or two, which shows him now leading by a point after trailing by as many as seven. But these Senate polls are so unreliable, it's hard to tell. But clearly, the Republicans have to win Wisconsin. Let's put it this way. Look, there's four states that are competitive that the Republicans have incumbents in or are retiring that they have to hold if they have any chance of taking the Senate. One is Pennsylvania. Two is North Carolina, where it's neck and neck, but the Republican looks pretty good. The third one, well, let's go to Wisconsin, because if they can win Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and North Carolina, and then there's Ohio, where you have the Republican Rob Portman retiring, the author J.D. Vance is looking pretty good there. if Republicans win those four that they currently have incumbents in, and they win one state held by Democrats, they'll take control. But if they lose one of those four states that they currently hold, you know, then they've got to win two of the toss-up races in states held by the Democrats, and that becomes pretty tough. So the Wisconsin race seems to me to be very much sort of a canary in the coal mine, or will prove to be, because if they can't take down Ron Johnson with all the baggage that they're trying to lay on him in a state that is net out more Democrat than Republican, and yet Johnson's won twice there, then I suspect it's going to be a really good night for Republicans. If Johnson loses, they could still take the majority, but it will really be an uphill battle. I think that's the bellwether state, if you will, in my opinion.
And what are your predictions at this
knife's edge? Knife's edge, knife's edge. I mean, the Democrats have the luxury of not having to win a single new seat, even though it's at 50-50. Republicans have to win one. My guess would be, if I had a gun held to my head, I'll say the Republicans will take it to 51, and they'll win the House. But the reason I say it is not because of the candidates in these races. Mitch McConnell was heavily criticized for saying, well, we'll probably win the House, but in the Senate, the quality of the candidates makes more of a difference, which was his way of saying that guys like Dr. Oz and Herschel Walker are dragging down the party.
Right, right.
So I think if Republicans had more sort of mainstream conservative candidates, they would clearly win the Senate. But because they've got at least three people that are controversial candidates, it's really hard. It's really hard to say.
According to another political analyst from New York, some of the Republican candidates are doing everything they can to hurt their colleagues' chances.
Monday afternoon, Vice President Harris met with a group of civil rights leaders and reproductive rights leaders, Planned Parenthood, NAACP, National Action Network, all of us, some of us virtually, and was arguing about how do we really fight to mobilize voters around nonpartisan lines, around this issue of taking away women's rights to vote and converge civil rights and women's rights. If we'd waited 24 hours, we wouldn't have had to have the meeting, because Lindsey Graham did it for us. I think that he has energized a base that none of us, with all of our organizational apparatus, could have done. It was amazing that he would come out and say, no, we're not going to do this state by state. No, it's not states' rights. We're going to nationalize it. And I don't care how you cut it. I agree, the data says, you know, 15 weeks and then it starts going down. But the headline that everyone got was, we're going to make a national ban on abortion. It couldn't have been better for those that are in a movement that we're trying to help converge. And it couldn't have been better for the Democrats. I remember growing up, I had a mentor that told me that, Al, if you see a guy on the edge of a cliff about to go over, give him room. Don't turn a suicide into a homicide. So I say to the Democrats, back up and let them go over the cliff.
Don't turn a suicide into a homicide, Tim.
Well, I think what's happened here, I'm trying to explain something that many people can't understand, including myself. I mean, I understand why he did it, but I don't agree. What the Republicans have had terrible trouble with since the overturning of Roe versus Wade is coming up with what they're going to do next. You have individual states, each of which are heading further to the right or further to the left, either restricting abortion much more heavily or much more lightly, depending on whether you're a blue or red state. And this incoherence among Republicans about how they would handle this newfound a world where abortion goes state by state, it's been a mess for them. They've not been able to have any kind of unified message. So I think what Lindsey Graham is trying to do is to say, okay, if we can all agree on these 15 weeks so that when candidates across the country are confronted by pro-choice activists, they can say, we support 15 weeks, not, well, it depends on the state, or I'm not really sure if it should be 10 weeks or 15, or whether it should be through the entire pregnancy. He's trying to get a unity to the Republican message in response to Roe versus Wade. Now, that said, he's ruined the basis of the constitutional decision, which is to send it back to the states, which should properly each decide individually what to do about this issue. That's
there must be a basis in the enumerated powers that Congress has to legislate in this area. That, to me, is the fundamental flaw with anything that Lindsey Graham wishes to pass, which is how can they find the authorizing grant for them to legislate in this area. That's to me the legal and constitutional argument. The political argument, though, is, and forgive me for just being a straight up cynic, I guess, unlike your analysis, is he wants to differentiate himself to be able to run for president if Donald Trump doesn't want to. And this is his attempt to get out front of some issue. And
I think his days of running for president are long past because he's failed a couple of times badly. I mean, that dog just ain't hunting, if you know
really
what I mean.
You think he's done for good on that front?
I do. Yeah, he's got there's no constituency for Lindsey Graham. I think, MAGA people like him, then they hate him, then they like him, then yeah. They hate him. He sort of blows with the wind. I think, seriously, in this case, he's trying to get a cohesive message across, but I think it's a misfire because...
And the timing. Oh,
I mean, look.
He got roasted by Jesse, what's his name, on Fox to his face for it. Basically an unforced error. The Democrats are tripping over their unforced error with the inflation. They're jumping around, singing and dancing with this inflation bill. Meanwhile, the markets are crashing. And that moment was kind of not allowed to exist politically for Republicans because of this abortion.
Well, there's another way to look at this, too, which is that lest we forget, the Democrats, as soon as Roe v. Wade was overturned, they tried to bring forth a bill that would essentially that would go beyond Roe versus Wade, that would make all abortions legal, all abortions nationally. Okay. So this is the bookend to that bill. So if Republicans are smart, what they'll do is saying, yeah, I support 15 weeks. What about you? Put the Democrat on the defensive to answer the question and then let the chips fall where they may.
They
can also point out, look, yes, I support 15 weeks. The Republican bill says 15 weeks. The Democrat bill said basically unlimited abortion on demand in the whole country. So they can point out which of those two positions is more extreme, really. That's what they're thinking.
The thing that they could do is say, we're comfortable with the notion that it is a bit chaotic. There are 50 different states. And there may be 50 different rules with some small changes. There may be like three main types of rules with some tweaks here and there. But the idea that we are we're going to live under a national law with respect to abortion, it seems like even Lindsey Graham isn't comfortable really with the opposite of that, which is 50 separate abortion rules.
Well, I think that they just feel that this is not a viable strategy for them. Look, I mean, if this was 50 years ago, it wouldn't even be an issue. Things were the same under the law as they are now, which is that each state could make their own decision about abortion. We have the same thing now. The problem is it follows a 50-year period, half a century, where women were told it is your right within the Constitution to terminate your pregnancy. Yeah. And it's that part that, you know, Republicans could give a good explanation that this is 10th Amendment friendly. This is a federalism friendly because each state gets to decide for themselves. And look, if you're going to have an abortion, hopefully for you and for your fetus, it's the only time you do it in your life. You do it once, maybe you do it twice. There's half the country that you can get to that where you can have an abortion to terminate your pregnancy and kill your fetus or your baby, depending on your outlook on it. So really, practically, things haven't changed all that much, except for people that want abortions in red states or refuse to leave the state for a once-in-a-lifetime event. I mean, if you were dying of cancer, Scott, and there was one place in the country that could treat you, would you complain that it was in a different state than where you are right now?
You know, we played it, I think it was maybe like 2 months ago, but I think it was the Montgomery County, Maryland county executive was paying for marketing of basically move to our county, relocate messaging for people in the national capital area. And the rationale behind his purchasing decision, Tim, was that a woman who might live in Virginia, for instance, would change jobs, sell their home in Virginia, buy a home in Maryland and move there so that if she wished to then terminate a pregnancy, she could do so within her home state.
Thank you. You put it perfectly. You put it exactly perfectly. And
who
that's
wants to
what
travel
Democrats
across
Democrats
state
are trying
lines to terminate a pregnancy, Tim, I ask you.
Democrats think, here's their basic premise, is they think that abortion is essentially going to trump inflation in the eyes of the average person. So let me put what you said in a slightly different context.
Trump
they're
inflation,
going to say,
you mean eclipse inflation as an important.
Yes, well, eclipse inflation, yes, right. Okay. Now, you know, the thing is that you could put what you said in a different context, which is, you know, I go to the store and a piece of meat, which used to be $7, is now $16. The cottage cheese I like to buy used to be $4 for $1.50. Now they're $4 for $3.75. And you know what? That's pretty bad. But at least I can go home and abort my child in this state, right? That's what you're basically saying, that pocketbook issue.
They say it's bodily autonomy, by the way. You're right, but you got to work on your wording of the message there.
Your bodily autonomy.
Yeah, at least I have bodily autonomy. That's how they sell it to the ladies.
But this is all a political question at this point. I mean, everything we've said is true. It's a matter of which, you know, argument sort of carries a day. And in all my judgment and wisdom, cannot see how the fact that a woman will have to travel perhaps to get an abortion, or in fact, live in a blue state where the abortion regulations are going to become loosened. Are they going to vote against it because the Supreme Court said you couldn't have it as a right of birth? I don't think so. Pocketbook issues are still pocketbook issues, and inflation is the single most damaging political situation any politician can have running for re-election, except perhaps a pandemic, ask Trump. But inflation affects every single transaction that every single person has and is every time a reminder of who's in charge while all these prices are soaring and inflation is rising and we're heading to a recession and people, I don't know, can they not find work or employers can't find people to work? I mean, I think all of this stuff is going to predominate over abortion, climate change, and paying off student loans with taxpayer money. And that's why Biden is attacking Republicans. They don't think abortion is enough to get him over. They do think that if they attack Trump voters and scare Democrats and left-leaning independents into believing that Trump is hiding behind every candidate, every curtain, waiting to, I don't know, do whatever it is they think that he does, then you've got, and you've got something.
I don't want you to opine on the likelihood of this happening on the exit question for Timothy Elting Donner, LibertyNation.com, senior political analyst. I just want the answer if it does happen, how it affects the races. Donald Trump gets arrested by the federal government. What happens in November? I assume that has to change things somewhat radically, right?
Well, yeah, thank you for asking that question because it's a very relevant one. I do think this is more your bailiwick than mine, but I do think that since the special master has been approved, that it probably slows things down enough that he won't be arrested before the election. It would strike me, it's more likely again, it's done after, but if they do, okay. Boy, Donald Trump has always been an X factor, but this would be the ultimate X factor because on the one hand, I think that everybody's already pretty much made up their mind about Donald Trump. On the other hand, the only thing that hasn't happened to him at the hand of his enemies has been to be arrested. So you throw everything way up in the air when that happens. And I suppose on balance, Scott, toss a coin. I think it probably benefits Republicans very slightly because they'll see this, whether it's true or not, as a continuation of the persecution of Donald Trump by official Washington and the powers that be, as opposed to the independents who already know that they think Trump is kind of dodgy when it comes to living under the law.
And well, I think you're right there in the analysis. So the middle, we talked about the 40% on the other one side and the 40% on the other side with respect to the Georgia election. Let's call that the same in just about every election. You can put up a dog, they're going to get 40% no matter what. But yes. I think what happens is for the middle section, you carve out, that's a net loss for Republicans with an arrest, meaning it's an odious, off-putting in the extreme existence from which to have a political sort of power base is behind bars. It's bad. But I think that there is some real motivation there for a significant number of Republican types who are like, you know what? I got to go get a lawn sign. I got to start writing checks. I've got to make sure I get to the polls and bring two friends.
Because then it becomes strictly tribal. You're going after the chief of our tribe.
Absolutely. It's a team. It's just a team sport, A and B.
I think it becomes a team sport. And I see the left is already sufficiently energized against Trump. The right can be energized by this. Plus, the fact is that Trump is not on the ballot. So there could be some Republicans who would be relieved that he got arrested because then they think that he's not going to be the nominee in 2024. And we don't have to go through all of this nervous breakdown in the whole nation when Donald Trump hits center stage again. And therefore, they'll like the Republicans more because it's likely Trump will be out because he's indicted.
I just disagree with you on one point there when you said that Donald Trump is not on the ballot. He's on every ballot.
Well, he's on
every election.
Every ballot and no ballot. Yeah. So, you know, that's another X factor. To what degree do people think they're really voting for Trump?
We will continue to appreciate your observation and analysis of all this on the pages of LibertyNation.com. And thank you for joining us on this episode of The Uprising. We'll see you next week, Tim.
Look forward to next time, Scott.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Entertaining, informative, and just plain fun. Watch Liberty Nation's The Conservative Five, produced by conservatives for conservatives. C5's The Left Free Zone, hosted by Liberty Nation's Lisa K. Donner, joined by a raucous, irreverent panel of authors, deconstructing leftist narratives, debating the hot topics, and remembering to laugh.
Heard it here first.
Join the official conservative safe space.
You only did that to piss Jeff off.
Liberty Nation's The Conservative Five.
That's it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, LN Radio, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for joining The Uprising. This program is a production of libertynation.com, where truth is making a comeback.